It's not just one technology, or even some people call it a device. It's a set of technologies that we have assembled to work seamlessly and adapt, to each and every patient.
Welcome to AI for Pharma Growth, the podcast from pioneering pharma artificial intelligence entrepreneur, Dr. Andre Bates. This show aims to demystify AI for all those in biopharma, from startup biotech right through to big pharma. Each episode focuses on all things AI and future tech related to help pharma execs to navigate through the and benefit from the sometimes confusing but magical world of AI-powered tools to grow and get real-world results.
Today's episode is how to use AI-powered tech to communicate with your brain alone. People with motor disabilities from neurodegenerative conditions and stroke and trauma or infection have relied on computers with speech output to communicate with others. An example people are familiar with is Stephen Hawking. But these older devices were slow and prone to error. Then, of course, came the generation of neural chips. And so this is basically a brain-computer interface, which allows users to transmit and receive information between the wireless device and the brain. And an example of that is Neuralink, the Elon Musk company. And that they're initially focusing on helping people with paralysis regain independence through the control of computers and mobile devices. But that device is invasive and requires surgery to implant it. Today, I am happy to talk about the fact that we now have a new generation of device that is non-surgical and works straight out of the box. It's AI-powered and it enables people with no voice and no motor abilities to communicate. Today, I'm with François Gand, the founder and CEO of Neuro, N-U-R-O, the world's first zero-surgery neurotechnology able to adapt instantly to a wide variety of conditions, such as stroke, trauma, and neurodegenerative diseases. Their products allow communication and computing by the brain and can be deployed in most human beings indoors or outdoors in seconds, regardless of their state of health. I am so excited to have you on the show, François. I mean, it's such a pleasure. I really am so excited to hear all about this. I have read that people call you the computer whisperer, and it seems a lot broader than computer whispering. I'd love to know more about your background and how you got into this, where you started, and what actually led you to found Neuro.
Well, Andrea, thank you so very much for having me on your show. It's a great pleasure and honor to be here today. My journey has been a very interesting one. I started really computing at an early age, built my first computers, and for servers, eventually ended up in the software coding side of things. And I always looked at a computer really as almost like a paintbrush, if you wish. And I'm very artistic. I'm also very interested in pushing the technology to the extreme limits, I would say. And for me, it was a tool very early on to create and innovate on various aspects of technology. And I also wanted to be an entrepreneur. I started, very, very early before my 20s, actually creating and generating software, selling software to small companies originally, and then eventually much larger companies. And Neuro is my fifth company. So I've been really in the tech entrepreneurial aspect of things for about 30 years right now. Yeah. And Neuro really has been an effort that actually came from my own personal life and some events that happened to me. The very first event was the passing of my mother, who after a ski accident, unfortunately, had a brain surgery, and the brain surgery did not go well at all, and she passed away from it. So this was kind of my first, so to speak, interaction with the brain in a way, and unfortunately not a great one, because I was supposed to be one of the leading surgical approach in France at the time. Yeah, it just didn't work out. And the second one was my father. So my father was ultimately diagnosed after 6 years with the Alzheimer's disease. And again, him living in a westernized country, you would think that that process would not 6 years to eventually get to a diagnosis, but it was a very, yeah. very slow, very manual process.
Yeah.
I think he had two MRI scan over 6 years. I mean, it was just a very brutal, lengthy, diagnosis process, which to me was really kind of problematic because I do like to solve things as quickly as I can. And it was just, the obviously the matter of the disease itself is daunting as well.
Yeah.
And then last but not least, in my fourth company, which at the time was global and it was operating on five continents.
Yeah.
I ended up having a traumatic accident. A member of my staff closed a car door on my right hand, and my right hand got stuck in the hinge of the door, and a part of my hand literally exploded. So I was amputated on the spot by that car door. This led to seven reconstructive surgeries. They wanted to really amputate the whole thing, and I absolutely refused that. I said, you know what, I absolutely want to have my hand and all of it. So I asked them to rebuild it, and it took four major infections, 10 months of narcotics, which almost killed me. And eventually, I luckily survived it and ended up in a state which I will always remember. I think the very first time that I went back into my offices, I tried to compute, and actually put my right hand on the mouse and try to click on something. And obviously, at that time, my hand was, I had a lot of bandages, so I was like, okay, this is not really working. And I tried my left hand, and my left hand could not do it, period. For some reason, my brain, over all those years, was not able to actually hit a close button of a window.
Yeah.
And this was kind of the aha moment for me. It was like, okay, if anyone suddenly, at the time, for me, it was a sudden realization, but suddenly is no longer able to compute, which again was my tool, really my life in a way. What's next? What can I do next? And I had a lot of experience, obviously, with Microsoft Windows, Apple OS X, even Linux, and I really decided to kind of look and alternatives, right? So assistive technologies such as eye gaze or any other type of switches really were quite limited. There's some aspects of it that work, but I eventually learned over time that some of those technologies failed drastically with some of those individuals that end up in institutions where they can no longer use a computer. And it kind of, if you wish, kind of got all together because at the time, my father was degrading and degenerating even further. And I decided to actually really kind of dive into neuroscience, if you wish. Yeah. So, my background is entrepreneurship, business, technology, but I really needed to kind of address what was going on.
Yeah.
And pretty much I did a major cross-analysis of neurodegeneration, specifically on Alzheimer's, looking at every methodology on diagnostics approach to Alzheimer's. I do believe that I read most of the scientific publications on Alzheimer's, at least on the diagnostic side of it. And eventually, I ended up writing my very first patent on Alzheimer's diagnostic.
Wow.
So most people don't know that, but I mean, that's actually, I started really my neuroscientific approach on Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
And in that journey, so to speak, I had the pleasure of interacting with someone from the Canadian federal government. And one day I said to him, I said, you know what, I'm thinking about something. You think it's going to be crazy, but what if, we could actually control the computer with your brain, if you don't have your hands or if you can't do it anymore, what can you use? And to me, it was kind of a natural progression as to the decision-making process, you know, like, and how I was interacting as a power user in technology. I wanted the speed. I wanted the ability to interact with the computer again the way I used to.
Yeah.
The gentleman on the other side said, you know what, Francois, I know you for many years right now, and if anybody can do it, you know, I think you should try it. I think you should definitely, you know, get a swing at it. And I did. And for a year and a half, roughly, I worked by myself and started building, you know, different approaches, different architecture, you know, looking at different aspects of coding and how things could take place. And eventually I met a gentleman one night on GitHub, and a little thumbnail, one of those little icons, and, you know, sent a message, say, hey, you know what you seem to be working on is kind of what I'm working on as well, and would love to connect, you know. And we connected, and this was kind of the beginning, so to speak, of a friendship that lasted, you know, many years. And the reality is we started working thousands of miles away from each other at the time via Zoom. And pretty much we ended up in an accelerator. So the very first accelerator was actually in the Waterloo region here in Ontario. Which really was more business oriented, but the first main accelerator that we got into is called IndieBio, which is in San Francisco.
Yeah.
And we are the first Canadian company to ever be selected and ever graduate from that program, which is a very, very intense program, like more longer than Y Combinator, for instance. And there's more rewards, you know, at the end of it, if you make it. And eventually, after 4.5 months there, we ended up in Palo Alto, and to our complete surprise, in a way, one of our hundreds of iterations ended up with a gentleman who, at 40 years of age, had a brainstem stroke while driving his children to school.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, he was a CFO in Silicon Valley, you know, successful man, and ended up in coma, ended up fully paralyzed, and so on. And out of, you know, my very first visit, we put our devices with him externally, and out of nowhere, you know, this gentleman cannot talk. Okay, he's mute.
Yeah.
He yelled. Literally.
Oh my God.
And this was, you know, we were in a Zoom meeting with some of my colleagues, and it was just completely outstanding. You know, we were just shocked that suddenly this man with no training, no calibration, ended up interacting with our system. He started typing, he started interacting with his Alexa system, you know, just out of this iteration. And this was really kind of the breakthrough moment for us. It was like, okay, we've got something here that we've got to push more. And this ended up being called NUOS, N-U-O-S. Originally, the new operating system. That was kind of
Oh, I see.
And NUOS really, at the time, was just one single edition. You know, again, out of literally hundreds of different iterations in our code. And that was the beginning. That was really the beginning of everything at the time. Like, it was like, okay, we know now we've got something, we've got to work from there.
That's an incredible story. I'm so sorry about all of the tragedy that you've had to endure to get to this point. But I have seen that before, that some of the most amazing companies come because the founders have experienced things and there's been no way that they can solve those problems, and they set about to do it. So kudos. I mean, you've done an amazing, amazing thing. And then that first moment where you had it with that person who had the brainstem stroke, that must have been the most exhilarating moment for you guys.
Yeah, we were shocked. We were in awe, like absolutely, like everybody that was in the bedroom of that gentleman, and I had a couple of the people remotely connected, and we were completely shocked. There's a video recording on neuro.world. You can see it. And the name of the gentleman is Henry.
Yeah.
He's the TEDx speaker as well. I mean, he's a famous individual. But it was just absolutely incredible to see someone like him literally yell out of that very first experience with our system.
But you must have known it was going to work because you'd got it to that phase.
Yeah, right? You know what? I mean, so there's another story. It's a longer one, but pretty much the general manager of IndieBio has a system which is called Killer of the Week. And every single week on Friday, if you do not pass pretty much the test by your peers in the program and by the management of IndieBio, you can literally get kicked out of the program. And this was the very last killer of the week of cohort number 6 of IndieBio. And pretty much I had the challenged, general manager, said, Francois, show us that you can do it. And I was like, all right, let's do everything we can to make this happen. And, you know, somehow the gods were with us, because the day before in Palo Alto, in Los Altos Hills, we went to that house. And, you know, had this gentleman interact. I had recorded this. And on the day of the killer of the week, I brought a laptop, turned the video on, put that in front of, you know, the group. And everybody was completely shocked. We won the killer of the week, the last killer of the week. It was just like, you know, it was like, okay, now we've got it. Now we know that we got something solid and we can work from there.
That is just amazing. I mean, that must have, I just can imagine how you must have felt. That must have been incredible. Can you tell me more about the device? Because it just blows my mind. How does it work?
Yeah. So, you know, the reality is this very first milestone eventually got known a little bit more by some clinicians. So the Mount Sinai Health System in New York City, Shirley Reiner Beauty Lab in Chicago, and others. And we eventually got connected with another case. It was a young man who had not communicated for several years. And he was, was stage 6 ALS. So very advanced stage of incapacitation, on life support, no movement of any kind, no voice, advanced ptosis, so his eyelids was going down, you know, very, very limited vision capability. And they had tried everything. Like, they had tried eye gaze, they had tried, you know, other approaches in BCI, like, you know, a classic P300, and, you know, some of the classic neurological, surgical, or non-surgical approach. Yeah. And nothing was working. Like, it was just not happening at all. That gentleman was completely unable to communicate. And I got there in February 2019, and literally within the first 5-10 minutes, that gentleman interacted and triggered our system. And, you know, this was kind of the same event, so to speak, that happened in California. Yeah. But one of the things that we realized is that gentleman had obviously another pathophysiology. He was very, very advanced. And we realized that the code that we were working with had actually some limitation, because that gentleman was so, so, so advanced neurologically that he was not reacting, or the code was not reacting exactly the same way. So what we did actually is we, for the second time, rewrote actually our entire application. But instead of kind of erasing what we had done in California, we decided to create another subversion, if you wish, that we called Nuance Extreme. Okay, and to date, Nuance Extreme still exists. So we're now in the second generation of our system. So Nuance 2 exists, Nuance Extreme 2 exists. We also have mobile versions of both systems. And the Extreme version really started looking at those very advanced states, those individuals that have literally nothing. Like when you go, I don't know if you've experienced that on your end, but I mean, if you ever go into a room of an individual in that state, you actually wonder if that person is still alive. Okay, there is no movement, there is nothing. You could be an inch from their face.
Yeah,
their eyes usually are not moving. You know, there's nothing. There's nothing besides machines that are keeping those people alive.
Yeah.
However, if you are, you know, careful with what's happening, if you're aware of what's happening, you actually can feel that there is a human being there, that there's still someone there. That person somehow actually has cognition and is actually, he or she is actually understanding what's happening.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's really truly amazing to have that experience, because especially when you spend several days, you know, with those people, it's really kind of a, it's an out of this world experience in a way, because you're really, really into that person, and you almost, you know, telepathically, you know, communicate in some ways, right?
Yeah.
It's that bond that gets generated. And for us, it was another wall. It was another challenge. It was like, okay, how are we going to get around this one?
Yeah.
And we did. We actually did, you know, and it's funny because I remember us saying, you know, what about this? Oh, no, it's not going to work. How about that? It's not going to work. And, you know, at one point in time, I said, you know, let's try everything.
Yeah.
Let's just try every single approach that we can think of. And let's see if one sticks, you know, let's see if we can actually make this happen. And we did. And we actually did. And this was really probably the second major breakthrough for us, where we knew at the time that by thoughts, like literally by thoughts, nothing else, someone could start controlling a computer. Okay. And one of the things that I do, and I still do it today, is I really start those individuals with music, because I think music is just a beautiful way of interacting with technology.
Yeah.
And it's also, it generates kind of an emotional response, if you wish, especially if you're listening to tracks that you enjoy or that you've enjoyed
yeah.
the best. It's for me a way for those patients to start understanding that they now have opened another door, that something is happening. And in some cases, I don't even say anything. In some cases, like very recently, I'll tell you a little bit more about this in a few minutes. I implemented, or we implemented, a patient, and I was completely uninvolved. Like I didn't train that young girl. I didn't get involved at all. I trained the parents for 2 hours, and I stepped away and I said, you know what, you guys go ahead. Let's see what happens.
Yeah.
And the reality is, it's absolutely amazing to see those individuals suddenly take over their favorite tracks of music and take over their computer, right? And every time, pretty much, that happens, I know, because of that response, because of that new bridge that has just been generated, that we can then go further. Right.
Yeah.
So once I do the music, we go into, you know, very critical kind of binary 2-bit yes, no type of communications. We eventually graduate to more complex, all the way, if we can, to, you know, multi-bit, all the way to 12-bit level of communications, potentially keyboarding if the person is capable of doing so. And we also eventually get to video control, for instance. So you can, you know, imagine controlling YouTube with your thoughts.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that is more challenging, obviously, because you're dealing with longer content, you know, lengthier content. But it's absolutely truly amazing to see those people taking over, you know, a computer where before they've been isolated sometimes for many years.
How do you get the device to communicate? How do you get the thoughts to communicate with the device?
Yeah. So we have a 4-layer stack of technologies that seamlessly work together, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just one technology, or even some people call it a device. It's not even a device per se. It's a set of technologies that we have assembled together to work seamlessly and adapt, you know, to each and every patient. There is a hardware set of components. I'll show them to you. I know this is a podcast, but you can see this. So we have now 6 pairs of designer glasses that are really beautiful.
Wow. Yeah.
You have no idea that, you know, I have something here that is actually capable of listening to my neurological signals. And then we have an ultralight headband, which also looks at the neurological signals on the prefrontal cortex, so the frontal part of the human head.
Yeah.
And that eventually goes into wireless communication with software, algorithms, and AI deep learning methodologies. So you have those 4 layers of technologies all working together to process what's happening. And the other part of it, which is kind of coming back from my, you know, from my tech background, is I really wanted to make this multimodal, multi-threaded, if possible, or at least multimodal, where you had the ability to listen, to monitor passively everything that those people could give us, right? And this was, again, going back to the second case, it was like, okay, how can we work with this? And the idea was, let's get as much signals that we can, and let's process them from there. So some people have certain signals that you can work with, some people have others, and it's just a matter of, you know, very, very quick understanding what you're facing, what kind of conditions you're working from, that it's, you know, an ALS patient, a traumatic patient, an infectious patient, a stroke patient. You know, there's all sorts of variation, that it's also a juvenile, you know, a child or a teenager, an adult or an elderly person. There's different, you know, different signals from that perspective, or different signatures in the neurological signals that you work from. And having that capability and this ability to switch instantaneously and select instantaneously all of these, those different access methodologies, allow you to have a very flexible system, which can adapt, again, very quickly to a lot of different people.
That is so cool that the only parts that, that actually are required to read inside on top of the tech stack that, you know, is sitting elsewhere are the glasses and the headband. I mean, that's so amazing.
Right. And the other part of it, so this goes back, you know, from my early research and you know, attempts. And one of the things that was very obvious for me is that I did not want to recreate what the neuroscientific researchers were doing. Okay, I really looked at it not only as a tech user, but also as someone that has done literally thousands of user interfaces, and, you know, has developed pretty complex technologies, but still makes them easy to use. So the power is behind the scene, but the user is actually has all those tools and those automation, you know, really at the click of a mouse, and if you can have a mouse using, you know, such features. And for me, it was obvious that having, you know, a lot of cables or even a cap on your head, you know, you have hair, you have all sorts of noise, you have all sorts of things going on, was just not the way to go. And one of the aspects also that I realized is that by going on the frontal part of the head, obviously, there's, you know, it's a blank canvas in a way, but it's also where you make your executive decisions. This is where, you know, the brain is actually operating in a slightly different way. This is not the motor cortex. It's just looking at things in a different angle. So we spent a lot of time looking at what the prefrontal cortex was capable of giving us. And this is really how we built, you know, the architecture. So it's easier, it's instantaneous access, and it also works with neurological signals that are very different than what the other providers, you know, work from.
That's so interesting. When I was doing my PhD over 30 years ago in neurology, it was basically we would use those skull caps with the electrodes on them to collect the data, to collect ERP data. And we'd have electrode gel that we'd put in under the caps to get the conductivity right. So this is just astounding how far you've come. I mean, amazing. And so you're telling me about these amazing individual cases. Is the way that you've tested it just on an individual case-by-case basis, or have you conducted clinical studies, or how did you adapt?
Yeah, how did we do it? So we started really one by one by one by one. This is really, this is, you know, this was the kind of the aspect of the technology development, really, because I still to date, I'm more than willing to take any single individual, no matter where they are in the world, and, you know, try to resolve pretty much a challenge that they have. We started working with large institutions. So there's going to be a lot more that I'm going to be announcing very, very soon at that level. But we started working, and we have done over 100 implementation at this point in time. And we've also developed our technology to be multilingual or even cross-lingual. So we are in Canada, in the United States, in the Middle East. We've done some work in Asia. I am going to be announcing also the launch of Neuro in Latin America. So we've done so far, we've done 8 countries on 3 continents, right? But I'm gonna keep on pushing and making this a global solution with the Neuro's product line, simply for the fact that, you know, those individuals are human beings, and every single one of us can face this unfortunate condition, no matter where you live, no matter what your background is.
And so you've treated, or you've got it being used by over 100 people now?
Yep, yeah. And we've done, you know, one of the things that we've done also, which has not been announced yet, and I'll share that with you, you know, it's going to be public now, but we've done individuals in 2 different hospital groups who were clinically deemed to be non-cognitive.
Yeah.
So we're talking about people that they were non-communicative, but they were clinically diagnosed as no longer being cognitive. And literally on demand, within a few minutes, we had those people actually interacting with our systems.
Amazing.
This was a big shock for the clinicians and the family members and so on.
How did you get the data when you were analyzing, the brain activity of all these people to work with your devices? Did you have volunteers that you were working with, or was it all just academic, or how did you come up with
that? No, so we did a tremendous amount of work internally, actually. So we were our own guinea pigs at the beginning, and really kind of, you know, again, like I said, literally hundreds of iterations until we get to our first code base. We're on a third code base right now. We rewrote everything 3 times right now. We've changed programming language. We've changed our AI approach as well. So there's been a lot of work that has been done at that level, internally and eventually with patients. One of the things that's beautiful is that every single time that we implement, and if ever there is, you know, a need for a request or a new feature, we actually offer that for free. So any of our customers have lifetime free updates on our systems. And we give that to the community. We give it back to the community. So, you know, anyone that's working with us has the ability to say, you know what, you know, did you guys think about this, or could we have this feature, and so on. So, in the very best, of our capabilities, we do this, and we give this back to our users, all of our users.
That's lovely. And so, what kinds of AI are you using within the device?
So that's where we get closer to the magic sauce, I would say, to the secret sauce. We've done approaches with 6 different deep learning methodologies. Right. Okay. So it's not just straight AI. It's we work in the deep learning side of things. We've done work with several universities at that level, and we also work very closely with Google. So just a quick supportive note, you know, from our end towards Google, who has been very generous with us, has very helped us. We've been part of their inaugural accelerator program in Canada. We've been granted a couple of times by them, so they've been very helpful. And obviously, the platform is very powerful, and we can work with that on our end.
So it's very fitting in a way. So deep learning is a type of artificial neural network. It's very fitting that it's artificial neural network related that you're actually working with.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, that's right. And I think, honestly, we have really kind of scratched the surface so far. Like we have 4 editions of Neuros now. We also have another brand new edition that I'm not going to announce it quite yet, but it has been for 1.5 years in testing in Canada, and specifically with pediatric care and complex care with children. And I cannot wait until this new product comes out. And there's another one, so we have a third non-invasive neural technology, which is called the PAD. So the PAD originally stood for being the portable Alzheimer detector. That's how I call that very first product, which is based on my first patent on Alzheimer. And that one, I did announce it in November, I think, of last year. And very interestingly enough, we have been approached by the Edison Awards. We've been approached by Amazon Studios for them to actually use the pad on one of their upcoming feature films. So I'll actually show you the very first version, the real first version, so to speak, of that actually, which is a wireless helmet to scan ultra rapidly 5 key regions of the brain that are affected by neurodegenerative diseases. So it's, I would say it's an alternative to an fMRI and a PET scanner, primarily oriented to your general, for your general practitioners. So
yeah.
If you go back to my earlier statement, where sometimes people, even in wealthier countries, have to wait for months, if not years, you know, to get a diagnosis. This allows people at risk or people that just want to know what is their state of brain health, right? And this the goal of this particular technology is a 10 to 15 minute ultra rapid scan that is also processed multimodally and by AI deep learning to look at the de-identified data of those 5 key regions of your brain and tell you in your visit to your doctor, to your local doctor, you know, what's happening, you know, over time. So it's a very kind of early detection and continuous monitoring of your brain health and those regions that are impacted by neurodegenerative diseases. And, you know, we think that not only this is going to help a lot of people, but even when you look at pharma, you know, I think yesterday there was the first announcement by the FDA of an approval actually for the beginning of a therapy on Alzheimer's. Now the idea is that the pad could become your local, you know, portable wireless device, no matter where you live in the world. I mean, you don't, you could be in a village lost, you know, in the middle of nowhere and potentially still have an affordable device to actually see what's going on with your brain. So that's the third non-invasive neurotechnology that we've developed or that we're developing.
That is so cool. There's two questions I have for that. The first one is, have you worked with pharmaceutical companies? Because it's really important, particularly in Alzheimer's, to find the patients early, because otherwise there's a lot of neurodegeneration and the drugs don't work. So have you maybe worked with companies that have Alzheimer diseases to help facilitate the doctors getting, finding, diagnosing earlier?
Yeah, so I would love to. Actually, so this is a call to all big pharmas working in neurodegenerative disorders. You know, if you're interested in what we're doing, please do contact me. You can find me on LinkedIn. You can find me on neuro.world. You know, fill up a contact form and let's talk. One thing I can tell you is that I do have on my board of directors the past VP therapy of AstraZeneca and Roche, and also a CCO of the medicine code that was taken out by Novartis as well. And she's also a past VP for Pfizer, Wyatt, I think, and also AstraZeneca, if my memory is correct. So I do have some very, very talented people on my board of directors and advisors that you know, come from the big pharma world.
Yeah.
And we are more than willing to actually work at that level, because I think that you look at Nuance, or that you look at the second unknown, non-disclosed product right now, that you look at the pad, every single one of them actually give you entry data, you know, valid facts that the big pharma actually can look at and say, okay, are our efforts working? Are our therapy, in fact, changing whatever we're going after?
Yes.
You know, and there's been cases, you know, not very far, not long ago, where the FDA, for instance, has refused, you know, approval simply because data wasn't there. Well, there was not enough data, right? So, of course, if you have to put, you know, 5,000 people on an fMRI, you know, every single day, that's going to be a very difficult process to go through. On the pad, for instance, if you have that, I mean, this is like instantaneous, and you can have that everywhere, you know, very quickly, and it's much, much less expensive. And there's, you know, not a need of a whole crew of people to process this, and, you know, a massive room to do it.
It's got so many applications in pharma, because obviously it's, you know, we've got this whole shift to real world data, and how much more real world can you get than this? But what's also great is if someone is doing clinical trials in this space, then, you know, having those patients where this, you'd be seeing how it's impacting their neurological functioning, which would be so powerful. And And then, of course, in the sales and marketing side, you know, getting to patients as quickly as possible is so critical.
Absolutely.
I have another question, but it's more of a personal question. Can people buy this themselves? What is the cost and is it possible? My mother is 90 and she's always asking me, you know, is there anything out there that I can make sure I'm not going to get Alzheimer's, I can tell early?
So the Nuos 2 product line is available. So we've been cleared with different regulatory agencies and in various ways. And the Nuos 2 product line is available. One of the things that's very interesting with Nuos is that beyond communication, it also has built-in algorithms that can tell you different part of your state of mind, if you wish. So we know your level of cognitive performance. Yeah. We know your level of calmness versus anxiety. We know your level of appreciation, for instance. So that content right now is being used in Dubai at the largest autism therapy center in the world, where they actually change and modify their therapy for certain children with autism based on how the child reacts to content or even reacts to therapies themselves or teachers. Yeah. It's very, very interesting because we now understand and we can see instantaneously how that young person is actually neurologically responding to what the therapy is actually, you know, doing, so to speak. Yeah. So there is some really good insights, not only just about the fact that we can communicate with the device, but we can also look via our monitoring of those neurological signals as to what's happening in various state of mind. So that can be used, you know, in different ways. I mean, obviously, people that are affected by, let's say, a stroke, have been in critical care units, in New York City, where, you know, you can see that gentleman, let's say, is completely devastated because the day before everything was fine, and, you know, the next day that person can no longer move and can no longer speak. Yeah. So you have, you know, you have the analysis, obviously, as to what's happening mentally and so on. In terms of the pad, so the pad technology is not yet available, okay? And again, I'm looking for acceleration. I cannot wait until that particular device gets out as well. And then the second one is, you know, I can't tell you exactly what it is about, but that second one, I am looking for new patients in pediatric settings, potentially in geriatric settings. So again, if anybody out there is listening, feel free to communicate with me. What we're doing right now with that second, you know, undisclosed technology is really truly groundbreaking. And it's going to change the life of many, 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 many people around the world.
It's amazing. I kind of see this would be amazing to actually have in the home. One of my friends is building home, got AI in the bathroom mirrors that can make detection about micro changes that can predict particular illnesses, and toilets that do urine and feces analyses. And I see this, the kind of technology you have would also be something that would be amazing in smart homes for neurological health and predicting, you know, these kind of conditions very early on. And you can kind of see in the decades to come that should be in every home.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, this is a very, very good point. And it also relates to our IP. You know, like we've gone through many, many years of cross-examination with some of our patents. And the reality is, when you look at, you know, one of our patents for the pad, for instance, has 20 years plus another 810 days that USPTO gave us back. You know, when you look at, you know, almost 23 years worth of technology advancements, right?
Yeah.
I mean, God knows what's going to be happening in the next 6 months, you know, at this pace, right? So the reality is, we now have very strong IP, very strong position in non-invasive neurotechnology, and ultimately, as we, you know, continue to progress, as we continue to push the technology further, this is just really the beginning of the journey. Right? Yeah. And I think, yes, I do agree. I think we're going to get to a point where, you know, hopefully we can democratize this type of technology and have, you know, the individuals in need of it, you know, easily helped and assisted, and have factually the information that they need for a better life.
Yeah, amazing. Many of my listeners are from pharma, so companies, and pharma all have venture arms as well. For any companies that pharma or anyone who even has relatives affected by this, if you want to get in touch with Francois and his team, you can go to nuro.world and get in touch with them that way. Fascinating, just the most amazing story and the most amazing technology. I'm so impressed. So congratulations, you've done such an incredible journey. I'm looking forward to seeing where you go next and how this develops. So probably in another year or two, we should do another podcast.
Absolutely. I would love to. Thank you again. It's a pleasure being here. And, you know, again, if anybody out there thinks that what we're doing is interesting, obviously, you know, at the end of the day, it's up to every single one to decide if you actually want a chip, you know, inside of your body, or if you want foreign objects embedded there. You know, I have experienced personally, you know, what can go wrong with that, you know, and I think at the end of the day, our approach is very progressive. There's no risk, there's no pain, and there's no infection. It can be, you know, stopped instantaneously. You don't have to go back to a surgical center to remove whatever can go wrong.
Yeah.
And right. So there is, you know, it's a different philosophy. I do believe that, you know, there is ultimately a purpose for invasive neurotechnology that can make sense. But when it comes down to what we've already achieved, I think we've demonstrated that you don't need to actually, you know, go under the scalpel or anything else to do what we do.
So impressive. Such an amazing thing. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much, Andre. It's a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode of AI for Pharma Growth. If you have received huge value from this show, or maybe this episode has highlighted how you can use AI in your company, then we would love for you to support the show by leaving us a 5-star rating. Please make sure you hit the subscribe or follow button on your podcast app now to make sure you never miss an episode.